From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Steve Norman reporting. Here in the U.S., raw emotions filled a Charleston, South Carolina courtroom as relatives of the nine victims of the shooting massacre at Emmanuel AME Church addressed the man charged with their deaths. 70-year-old Ethel Lance was among those killed. Her daughter was in the courtroom Friday and spoke directly to Dylan Roth, the accused.
You hurt me. You hurt a lot of people. God forgive you. And I forgive you.
Charged with nine counts of murder, Roth will remain in prison, having accepted a no-bond arrangement for the murder counts. Bail of $1 million was set as an additional weapons charge. President Obama spoke Friday at the U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting in San Francisco.
At some point, as a country, we have to reckon with what happens. It is not good enough simply to show sympathy.
As he had said before, Mr. Obama framed his reaction to the Charleston murders in terms of curbing the use of guns, but was more emphatic this time, verging on anger. He said he refused to act as if shootings like this week's are the new normal. President Obama will travel to Ethiopia next week, becoming the first sitting American leader to visit Ethiopia, the headquarters of the African Union. White House said the visit to Addis Ababa will come after a previously announced trip to Kenya. Purpose of the trip is to accelerate economic growth, strengthen democratic institutions, and improve security in Africa. Both Kenya and Ethiopia have been important security partners with the United States in the fight against the militant group in Somalia known as Al-Shabaab. This is VOA News. U.S. State Department says terrorist attacks worldwide rose by 35% last year, with an 81% increase in the number of deaths. In its annual assessment of terrorism, the State Department said the groups Islamic State and Boko Haram were responsible for a high number of exceptionally lethal attacks. The story now from VOA's Pam Dawkins.
The State Department says Islamic State militants were responsible for 1,083 attacks last year, the most of any terror group. It says those attacks, such as one in northern Iraq that led to the killing of dozens of captured Iraqi soldiers, resulted in more than 6,000 deaths. In Nigeria, people scrambled for safety as police moved in following a November market bombing linked to Boko Haram. The State Department says the group's brutal tactics in West Africa resulted in more than 5,000 casualties last year. State Department officials say the U.S. has been working to shift its counterterrorism strategy to more effectively partner with countries where terrorist networks are seeking a foothold. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has rejected accusations that his country is aggressive, insisting that Russia has simply started asserting its interests more vigorously and consistently. Speaking Friday during a question-and-answer session at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, Russian leader responded to former French Prime Minister François Fillon, who said Russia is behaving increasingly more aggressively. Earlier this week, President Putin announced Russia's military will add more than 40 new intercontinental ballistic missiles to its nuclear arsenal this year. That announcement was strongly criticized by some Western leaders, including NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
So Russia is actually undermining the treaties we have had in place for several years, which are important for arms control. So we don't seek confrontation. We seek and strive for a more cooperative relationship. But the precondition for that is that Russia is respecting the borders of its neighbors.
Meanwhile, the European Union announced Friday that it has extended for another year sanctions against Russia for its March 2014 annexation of Crimea. U.S. government has crushed more than 907 kilograms of confiscated illegal ivory in New York's Times Square to raise awareness of the elephant poaching and wildlife trafficking crisis. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell said Friday's event in New York City would also crush the ivory market. Animal advocates say the trade in ivory threatens to wipe out African elephants.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes, executive editor of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for the Daily Beast. And here are the issues. In an encyclical address to the people of the world, Pope Francis urged swift action to be taken to combat global warming. In Moscow, President Putin said that 40 intercontinental missiles will be added to Russia's nuclear arsenal. Meanwhile, the fragile Palestinian Unity government was on the brink of breaking up due to conflict between the secular Fatah Party and Hamas, its Islamic rival. And in Charleston, South Carolina, 9 African Americans were shot to death while attending a Bible study in a church. A 21-year-old white man was arrested and charged with the murders. Well, this encyclical has certainly stirred a lot of attention. You know, I was a little surprised where the Pope says in there, he uses some pretty strong language. He said, you know, that the world is moving toward, Tim, becoming an immense pile of filth. I thought that was a little exaggerated.
Well, it was quite strong. He said, the earth, our home, is beginning to look more and more like an immense pile of filth. He said that inequality was the root of social evil. Mm-hmm. And he said that the problems of the poor should be radically resolved by rejecting the absolute autonomy of markets and financial speculation. I mean, this is strong language that has a lot of implications for politicians and decision makers all around the world, should they be Catholic. And even if you're not Catholic, something to reflect upon. Mm-hmm. You know, Jeb Bush was asked about this very issue. He's a Catholic. He's a practicing Catholic. And he talks about his faith a lot.
Yeah, read his response. It was very clever.
He says, I respect the Pope. I think he's an incredible leader. But he also says, I don't go to mass for economic policy or for things in politics. You know, I mean, it's one of those issues that he will have to deal with. There are a lot of social justice elements in Catholicism, and this most recent encyclical puts pressure on him and any other Catholic politicians to kind of reflect on whether or not climate change is something that needs to be addressed rapidly by Congress, by the president, by any other major policy makers.
Tom, you are a Catholic. Jeb Bush is a convert, I think, when he was in his late 20s or early 30s or something.
Right, and I think at least 4 other Republican candidates for president are Catholic. Marco Rubio, I know.
And for sure.
Rick Santorum and others. And so this does put...
I'm not sure, maybe Bobby Jindal, is he Catholic?
Probably so, but this will put pressure on them because already Republican candidates are trying to find a way to stay within the mainstream of the Republican Party, but also appeal to the more conservative element of the Republican Party. Some of those voters think that the science is not settled. The Pope seemed to believe the science was settled long ago. I know the Obama administration believes that. I think... while as an appeal for social justice, this encyclical was powerful, but it also has, I think, an unmistakable political tone to it. And I think Jeb Bush is right. Most Catholics don't show up at church for political advice. I mean, Senator John F. Kennedy, when he was running for president, in a celebrated speech in Houston, Texas, basically said no Catholic politician is going to take orders from the Vatican. And so this is an interesting document. It's an important document because the Pope, who is, it's fair to say, is more popular than any American politician and most other politicians, has a moral authority that some of his successors did not have. And so it's just by definition, it's an important document with political overtones or undertones, depending on your point of view, I guess.
You know, here's what I don't understand, and that is exactly what an encyclical is. Is it just the Pope's opinion, or is it something that is binding, or somewhere in between the two?
Well, traditionally, on matters of faith, on matters of dogma, and those sorts of matters, an encyclical is considered to be literally the word of God.
You mean that would be, for instance, the opposition to abortion?
Exactly right. But on something like this, I mean, Catholics are now not bound to vote against candidates who don't believe that climate change is man-made. So there is a distinction, but nonetheless, it is a powerful and important document for many reasons, the most important of which is the person who issued it.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course.
But it's not binding, certainly.
Well, you mentioned Jeb Bush's response. The Democratic response, of course, Tim, has been very enthusiastic, particularly by ones, you know, Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader in the House of Representatives, is famous as a Catholic who I think goes to Mass every day or quite frequently, and yet is for legalized abortion. So she sort of rejects that, but really has enthusiastically welcomed this new thing from Pope Francis.
Yes, she's not always been the biggest fan of the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when has disagreed with him, you know, in 2003 with Pope John Paul II, said, you know, I don't think a lot of these guys should be calling the shots, you know, said that in 2003.
Yeah.
So it really goes both ways, right, mm-hmm. that Democrats and Republicans can find themselves in awkward mm-hmm. positions because mm-hmm. of their faith and mm-hmm. the leader of their faith, the Pope.
Yeah. Well, the other part of it that you mentioned, Tim, and I'll start with you, Tom, and that is about capitalism. You know, popes have raised doubts about capitalism and being at least completely pure forms of it, and we don't see many pure forms of it now. On the other hand, the popes seem to miss something that, for one reason or another, and that is, as many people know, in this era of globalization over the last 20 years, where capitalism has really been the thing that has been growing the world economies, an estimate of as many as a billion people have been brought out of poverty by this increase in their, particularly in third world countries, but not only there. And yet the Pope seems to want to put shackles on capitalism, on free markets.
That was the one section of this encyclical, Fred, where I thought the Pope was just over the top.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he certainly can believe what he wishes to believe, but that, I think, basically saying forget about markets and capitalism and just stop that, it's not mm-hmm. important. I thought that was a classic case of a pope wading into a secular matter that really doesn't. I didn't see a mm-hmm. lot of theological aspects to that one. So I think that's that was the what I would call the soft underbelly of mm-hmm. this encyclical. There are other mm-hmm. things. I think the most important thing about it was the climate change thing,
yeah.
which will put a lot of pressure on a lot of politicians. Mm-hmm. And it's not a coincidence, of course, that President Obama was lavish mm-hmm. in his praise mm-hmm. of the pontiffs pontificating,
yeah.
Pardon the pun, but that part I think is important. But the whole business about forget about capitalism—it's mm-hmm. All bad. Mm-hmm. I think that was a little over the top.
Well, I think your pun was close to being over the top, but not quite. You know, we have to take a break here, only a short one. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
Here's a quick quiz. What do the letters LTATOMLAW stand for? We know the answer, right? Listen to Akwe Thompson on Nightline Africa weekends. Add to that 16 and 18 UTC on VOA, and we have a perfect score. That was easy.
All right, welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Tim Mack and Tom DeFrank. You know, Tim, here's my theory, and that is why the Pope has such a jaundiced view of capitalism, and that it's partly formed by spending so much time in Argentina. That's where he was as a Catholic leader in Argentina when he was elected Pope. And they do have a corrupt form of capitalism, if even you can call it that, in a place like Argentina. What do you think about that idea?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I mean, this is a pope that has managed to bring a lot of interest back into the Catholic Church, primarily based on his outreach to marginalized people,
mm-hmm.
to the very poor, to the ill, to people who are not that well respected in society, and mm-hmm. kind of bring a more humble approach to the church. And, you know, I mean, the Bible does contain a lot of teachings on, let's say, economics, not economic policy, but
yeah.
but the ways to view money, the ways to view mm-hmm. the rich, mm-hmm. And to humble oneself in the face of wealth and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Pope's teachings do reflect mm-hmm. that kind of basic social justice theme that runs through the Bible, and that is the undercurrent of a lot of Catholic teaching and understanding.
Yeah, well, and a lot of Christians remember the case of the rich young man who goes to Jesus and says, "I want to join the church. I want to be a follower. What do I need to do?" And Jesus said, "Give away all your money," and he kind of slinked away. He didn't want to do that. Well, I wanted to turn to another issue right now, and that's Tom, you follow these issues of nuclear weapons and military stuff. What in the world is Putin talking about where he needs? He obviously does not need 40 more intercontinental missiles.
This is
nuclear missiles.
This is gamesmanship. This is bluster. And I think at its basest, reduced to basics, I guess, this is President Putin lashing out at American plans leaked to the press in recent days that the U.S. is going to position heavy weapons in former Soviet Republic nations, closer to the Soviet Union than any place else. Now, we all know that there's a large U.S. military presence in Germany, although it's been reduced from 250,000 to down to about 50,000. But the notion of putting American weapons, not nuclear weapons, but American real weapons that much closer to the Soviet Union clearly stings Putin. Mm-hmm. Putin is still angry about Western sanctions because of his annexation of Crimea and of his mischief in Ukraine.
And those are going to be strengthened.
Those have not only extended for a second year, but strengthened. And he's nuts about that. I remember years ago a visiting group of Soviet journalists came to Newsweek, where I was working at the time, and asked to have a lunch in the bureau. And the whole essence of the lunch was, we in the Soviet Union don't get enough respect. We demand respect. And I just have to laugh at the memory of the leader of this delegation. He was demanding more respect, spitting grape pits onto the table, you know. That was his style. But
Now don't be a snob now.
Well, I don't know. I don't mean to be a snob, but I think it's an interesting metaphor, because Putin has talked often about trying to restore the grandeur that was Russia. He's certainly not a fan of the Tsarist imperial rule, but there was a time when Russia and the former Soviet Union were more highly regarded around the world as economic powers and military powers and geopolitical powers than they are now. And so I think this is all part of Putin's somewhat fragile psyche, to put it politely. You're right, he doesn't need more nuclear weapons, and he certainly is not going to launch them. He may be crazy, but he's not that crazy. And so I just think this is more, literally, more saber-rattling. And just you play games with my head, and I'll play games with your head.
Tim?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think Tom makes an interesting point about psyche. I mean, is this a move made in a position of strength, or is this a move that's made in a position of uncertainty and weakness and intimidation? And that's really one of the major questions that has surrounded Russia's moves in recent years. And it's one the president has actually pointed at, too. Whether Putin invading Crimea is an act of aggression that is a position of strength, or he's doing that because he can't do it through any nonviolent economic means, bringing them back into the sphere of influence. Yeah. I think that's a really interesting and good point that the president makes there. It's that look, if Mr. Putin and Russia were so strong, such a threat to the United States, so intimidating, it wouldn't even need to take these violent steps to have its way.
Yeah, well maybe. Anyway, okay, let's talk about the Palestinian Unity Government. Fatah on the one hand, on the West Bank, and Hamas in Gaza is falling apart. Tim, I'll start with you on this. You know, they had this Unity Government. They didn't seem very united as a government, and it really didn't seem to make much difference.
Yeah, I mean, there hasn't been a ton of unity here. There's been infighting since nearly the beginning.
Yep.
And so no one is all that surprised by the collapse. The question is whether more instability and a lack of political cohesion is going to do any good for the people of the West Bank or Gaza.
Tom?
I wouldn't say this is a mortal blow to the Palestinian Authority, but it certainly plays into the hands of Israelis.
Yeah, this is on the West Bank and the Fatah party, which is secular.
Right, exactly right. But, I mean, it gives Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yet more ammunition to say the Gaza Strip is in the is in control of the bad guys, the the people who want to see Israel destroyed and thrown into the sea, and so we're not going to negotiate with terrorists. It's unfortunate, but basically, as you say, it was never a unity. It was a unity government, but it was never much of a government. It was very not very ever unified, and even less so now.
Well, we could talk more about this, but I'm glad we left enough time to talk about this shooting and killing of nine people in a black church in Charleston, South Carolina. I've been in that church. You may have been there, too.
Yes, Tom. I have.
I was there to hear Jesse Jackson preach and also raise money. And when he was running for president, Jesse Jackson, the famous civil rights leader who lives in Chicago. And nine people killed by a young man, 21 years old, a very troubled young man. He seemed to be taking drugs. He was a high school dropout and so on, and with mental problems for sure. And yet it just, you know, when you hear about this stuff, Tom, in this day and age, it's just heartbreaking. You know, you feel so, you know, you feel for the parent, the people who've been killed and their families, and you think about race relations in the United States, which are not great at the moment.
Well, it is obviously it's almost a cliche to say it's a terrible tragedy, but it's more than just a terrible tragedy. As tragic as it is, it's just as a reminder that race relations are not where they ought to be in this country. I mean, it's interesting that in April in North Charleston there was a now infamous situation where a police officer was caught on videotape shooting an unarmed black man in the back several times who was running away from him. It was not a threat. It's just a reminder that for all good intentions, and I find Charleston to be a really enlightened city for the most part, even though...
Well, this young man was not from Charleston. He was from
100
miles away in South Carolina.
That's right. And I think the thing that's probably disturbing about a lot of people is he... His father bought him a gun on his 21st birthday as a present. So now we know what he allegedly did with that gun. It is just so unfortunate, and it's a real setback. And sooner or later, I think President Obama, for the first time in a long time, raised the issue of gun control, even as he did it in a very impassioned short remarks at the White House. He acknowledged that given the political climate right now, there's no way anything's going to happen on gun control. But he did say, as a nation, sooner or later, we have to address the reality that these sorts of gun-related tragedies happen more often in the United States than other places.
All right, time for another break, and then I will get to you, Tim, of course. We'll be right back with Issues in the News.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with Tom DeFrank and Tim Mack. Tim, what about this horrible killing? Nine people at a Bible study, and this young man sat there for an hour while the Bible study was going on. Races in his case, as Tom mentioned, President Obama raised the issue of gun control. There's another issue of mental illness and how it's treated in this country, and obviously this young man, the worst thing was giving him a gun. A better thing would have given him somehow treatment for a clear mental problem.
Right, and it's not a question of just treating those who are so mentally ill they're going to go out and commit violence. Mm-hmm. There's a tremendous problem of mental illness that that doesn't quite get to that point that also needs to be addressed in this country. Going into a church and gunning down nine individuals, including a state senator and the leader of a local community, while they're praying and reading the Bible, it's clearly the actions of a mentally unwell individual. The gunman managed to get, let's say, some 240 miles away before he was eventually apprehended. He was spotted by kind of a Good Samaritan who saw him in the car and followed him for quite some time and allowed the police to catch up, which is an interesting story. But the question...
And I think the people have been notified where he was going because of his cell phone. They tracked him.
Yeah, but as to the question of whether anything will be substantially done after a tragedy like this, I mean, the president has made speeches after 14 mass shootings over the course of his time in office. This is something that's not foreign to him at all, and you could hear a lot of frustration in his voice because he knew that despite, you know, how angry he got or how rattled he was, or how rattled everyone was in Congress and elsewhere, there would probably not be any action to be done. That there would not really be a response except for more statements of sympathy and more prayers, but no action.
What about race relations between African Americans and whites, Tom? It's been some rougher going after the incidents of police shooting unarmed suspects, and this certainly doesn't help.
Well, there's just been a whole bunch of incidents, not just the North Charleston one, the incident
in... Well, that policeman was charged with murder.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. Exactly right. But there have been other instances, I think in Cleveland, it was one instance where the police officers involved in a shooting were not charged with anything. And, of course, recently, not that many weeks ago, there was a... shooting, the death of a unarmed black man that triggered several days of riots in Baltimore, where race relations, especially between blacks and the Baltimore police, have been horrible for years. It's just a reminder that 51 years after Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 into law, you cannot legislate people's hearts and souls, and that there's a lot of hate still out there. And it is, of all the things that happened in recent days, I think this is the most distressing development, because I think if you believe that most people are good, not bad, this is the kind of thing that shouldn't happen, but it continues to happen. And when somebody shot a couple of dozen little kids in an elementary school in Sandy Hook, New Jersey, several years, and nothing happened in terms of gun control, that just kind of told you the reality. But it's a real blot on society, and you'd like to think that as a nation we're beyond this, but we're clearly not.
You know, some of the police, when they've shot and killed suspects, Tim, is one thing. They have a job to do, and maybe they don't do it well, or maybe they do it way too aggressively. But in this case, this was pure hate of this young man killing nine people at a Bible study. He had on his shirt or his jacket or something, emblems from, one from the prior apartheid white government in South Africa. So, I mean, these were clearly racist-inspired hate killings.
Yeah, I mean, and I think there's grounds to probably call it a terrorist act that is politically motivated, and I don't think we could put it in the same category as the tensions between the black and white communities and law enforcement, because this is really just someone going in and shooting innocent people, which is not related to law enforcement in any way. If anything, law enforcement reacted in an exemplary way following the shooting.
This just as we were coming into the studios, there was a report on CNN cable news network that the alleged shooter was quoted as telling police he wanted to start a race war. So that would also suggest some mental instability, but it's probably exactly what he thought, and that's pretty sobering.
How do you go about improving race relations after this?
Very hard, and it's not gun control, even though it's, you know, as President Obama said, it's still pretty easy to get a gun, and we don't do as good a job as we should of making it harder for people who shouldn't have guns, like this individual, to get one.
How do you stop a father from giving a gun?
You can't.
To his son?
You can't. That's the problem. You can't. You can legislate. You can have any number of laws you want, but you're not going to be able to keep a father who bought this gun legally to give it to his son.
Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.